Good afternoon, and thank you once again for joining us here on Public Radio, 89.1 FM Lakeshore Public Radio, serving Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland. I'm Tom Lounges. This is Midwest Beat, a program all about music and the people who make it. Well, today we're going to play some music from Bobby Darin. Music made by Bobby Darin originally and sung today by my guest. He'll be joining us live in just a few minutes. I'm talking about Christopher Cale Jones. We'll talk about his fabulous career. It's taken him all across America and perhaps the world. We'll find out. He's done a lot of shows, and you know him, you love him, and you'll know who he is when we get back. But first, let's feature Christopher Cale Jones doing Darin, Bobby's Biggest Hits, a show he's bringing to on Saturday, June 16th, to the Theater at the Center in Munster. This is a Bobby song that you may or may not know. It's a classic track, but we're going to feature it. As we like to say, let the music do the talking.
You know, you must have been a beautiful baby. You must have been a beautiful child. When you were only starting to go to kindergarten, I bet you drove those other childs wild. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. And when it comes to winning blue ribbons, I bet you taught those other kids how. Well, I can see the judges' eyes as they handed you the prize. I bet you made the cutest bow. Yeah, you must have been a beautiful baby, 'cause baby, won't you look at you now. Beautiful child, when you were only starting to go to kindergarten, I know you drove those other childs wild. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. And when it comes to winning blue ribbon, I bet you taught those other kids how. Well, I can see the judges' eyes as they handed you the prize. I bet you made the cutest bow. Yeah, you must have been a beautiful baby, 'cause baby, won't you look at you now.
Baby, take a look at you now. You must have been a beautiful baby. Hey, you know, that's a classic song that I've heard many, many times over the years and never really realized that Bobby Darin was the guy behind that song in many ways. A few different people have covered it over the years. And Bobby Darin is unique because he is the missing link, I'd like to say, as a rock archivist. He is the missing link between the Rat Pack Sinatra era and the rock and roll era, and the man could do it all. And I often ponder what would have happened had we not lost him at such a young age. And the music of Bobby Darin, sadly, has been, I guess, on the back burner for a while, but not any longer, because my guest is bringing it to the forefront, reintroducing it to a new generation, and rightfully so, because it is truly a building block of the popular music scene that we are enjoying today and enjoyed yesterday. Joining us now, Christopher Cale.
Cale.
Christopher Cale Jones, and I did kind of butcher that in the beginning, so it is Hawaiian.
It is Hawaiian, yeah. It's no one. It looks exactly like kale, so that's how everyone says it, but it's Cale. My parents had me while they were in Hawaii, and they loved the language, and they thought, well, how can we incorporate that into our children's name? So three of the four kids that my parents have all have these odd Hawaiian middle names that everyone butchers, so it's you're not in the minority there, and thank you very much for saying that.
We have a big show coming up. Bobby Darin at the Theater of the Theater at the Center in Munster, a beautiful venue. This is part of the Michael Ingersoll Artist Lounge series.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, see, Michael and I go back a long way. We were both together as actors in the show Jersey Boys. Mm-hmm. We did the first national tour, so the first company that went out after the Broadway production. I played Frankie Valli and he played Nick Massey. in that show. And and when he wanted to branch off with me and a couple other guys to do a group called Under the Street Lamp, we did that for about 7 years and were featured on public television. And then Michael branched off from that group to start his own kind of series of shows called the Artist Lounge Live Series. And he has a bunch of very talented performers who sing the catalogs of different music artists that he thought would be interesting to different audiences. So he has like an Etta James one, he has a Nat King Cole one, and I'm doing Bobby Darin.
Right. It's interesting because it's not just the songs.
Right.
It is a tribute, but it's not your typical tribute show. You actually recreate the life of the artist, all of you, when you do your specific artist. You share insights. You share stories. You take on the persona of the character while never saying you're the character, per se.
Right, yeah.
You do it in third person.
Exactly. So, yeah, we're not portraying a character, but at the same time, we're telling stories from their lives. So we're bringing an audience into what it was like to be them during this period, creating this music. And then we liken it to stories from our lives because we're all performers and professionals in our own rights who have our own careers, and so there's a lot of similarity. You know, I'm drawing on 7 years of touring the country with Under the Street Lamp, and so I know what that life is like. I know what it's like to be a touring musician, and so I can relate to a lot of the things in Bobby's story.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are a bunch of other details in Bobby's story that are completely different from my own and very compelling and interesting. And for people who just know his music, a lot of his life events will be very surprising. Even the people who are familiar with his life may be surprised at some of the songs that he was a part of.
Now, one of the things about Bobby Darin that I found interesting, I've had Roger McGuinn from the Byrds on the show many times.
Oh, great.
Roger, early in his career, played with Bobby.
Wow.
And we talked about the fact that Bobby was, everyone knows him for Splish Splash, Mac the Knife, things like that. But he was a serious student of jazz.
Yes.
He loved jazz and wanted to be a jazz performer.
Absolutely.
Now, how much of that is incorporated into your show?
It's definitely incorporated in the show. We talk about that a good deal, and we show it with the music. You know, when Bobby came out, the first song that kind of made him a hit was Splish Splash, which came out in 1958. And, it hit the top of the charts. It was he had always wanted to be a star, and that was the song that made it possible. And he became the star that everyone now knows him as. But as soon as that first album came out, he immediately started talking to his label and says, listen, I'm glad this song's such a hit. I love doing it, but I want to be a jazz musician. You know, he grew up listening to Bing Crosby, and as he was growing up, Frank Sinatra was hitting it big.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I want to have the same sort of career that these guys have. But like you mentioned in the intro here, he was also fortunate enough to have crossover hits in the rock and roll world, as well as in the R&B world and several others. So whereas you have someone like Sinatra, who's the king of classic standards and jazz and what Bobby wanted to be in a lot of ways, Bobby also had these other avenues of music that he was very successful in.
He also played instruments.
He did, yeah. Yeah, he played many instruments. He's the early 70s, he was featured in his own television show, The Bobby Darin Show, and you could see him on there playing piano and guitar and other things throughout the entire show. It's actually one of my favorite things to watch as I was preparing this show, just because mm-hmm. you got to see him as a performer and also as a sketch artist and an actor and get a real feel for his personality.
Well, let's go back right now and give you Christopher's version of Bobby's first hit. This is all of these songs today you're hearing are captured live on stage. So we're going to be back with Christopher in just a minute. So let's head to the bathroom.
Splish Splash, I was taking a bath along about a Saturday night. A rub dub, just relaxing in a tub, thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And then a splish splash, I jumped back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing, reeling with the feeling, moving and a grooving, a rocking and a rolling. Yeah, yeah. I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug. Yeah, a flip-flop, they were doing the bop. All the teens had the dancing bug. There was a lollipop with a Peggy Sue. Good golly, Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash, I forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on, yeah. They were a rolling and a strolling, reeling with the feeling, fishing and a splashing. One time they were a fishing and a splashing. Hoo-wee! They were a moving and a grooving. Whoa, they were rocking and a rolling. A splishing and a splashing, a reeling with a feeling. Splish, splash, I was taking a bath.
Ah, we're all scrubbed and clean. Yes, we are. Splish Splash, Taking a Bath, a classic track made famous by Bobby Darin, his first real hit. Performed there with Christopher Calais Jones, and he is bringing that song and the Bobby Darin story to Theater at the Center, 1040 Ridge Road in Munster, Indiana. You played Frankie Valli in Jersey Boys.
Yes.
You're now playing Bobby Darin in this production. I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you, who do you think is the better singer and overall entertainer? If you had to pick between the two that you are portraying.
You're going to get me in trouble regardless of what I say here. No, here's the thing. They both have very different voices and very different styles. You know, part of the reason that I got into Bobby Darin, and this was one of my ins to it, was I was doing the show Jersey Boys as mm-hmm. Frankie Valli, and one of the reviewers said, well, you know, he actually reminds me of a young Bobby Darin more than Frankie Valli. And at first, you know, I was offended. I was like, listen, I'm playing Frankie Valli. You should
right.
think I'm amazing at Frankie Valli. And they were like, no, he's a young Bobby Darin. But then that actually got me to look into his catalog and look into everything that he had done in his comparatively short career. And
right.
it really kind of sparked my interest in him. So now Bobby, I think, has much more of a pop sensibility, you know, whereas Bobby was more of like a rock and roll and jazz artist primarily. Frankie Valli was like a pop artist and,
mm-hmm.
and has these great pop tunes. He also has that incredible falsetto that he uses in, you know, all of his most popular songs pretty much. Bobby was not a big user of falsetto. He did it a couple times, but not much. So they're very, very different. But I think my voice is actually closer to a Bobby Darin type of voice because
I would agree with that.
Yeah, he's got a big booming sort of voice. And Frankie... you know, a pop voice has got to have a lot more finesse to it, and it tends to have like kind of a quieter, more finessed sound. Whereas Bobby was in your face. He's like, I'm Bobby, I'm here, I'm giving you my voice, and here it is. And that's always how I grew up singing, and what my voice eventually developed into. You know, I grew up similar to Bobby. I grew up the child of a performer, my mom had put herself through college by dancing. She taught ballet, she was like, listen, if you want to make a career on the stage, you've got to have a booming voice. This is before we had all the microphones we have now,
right.
and all of that. And she's like, she grew up in Detroit, Michigan, but she would see the touring productions that came to Detroit, and she would see these singers with these booming voices that had to carry over an orchestra to the back row of the balcony. And so when I was coming up and learning how to sing, my mom was like, you know, you need to be able to have that sort of power. So now it's kind of an innate thing in me, and that was something that Bobby just had. He was always in your face. He was always trying to make an impact as quickly as possible, for a large part because he kind of knew his time was short.
Right, right. Yeah, he grew up, he was sick as a child. I mean, incessantly, constantly sick.
Yeah, he had rheumatic fever like four times before the age of 13. And back then, it was a death sentence. You know, it was something we can manage pretty capably now. But the doctor, when he had his last bout at 13, came to his mom and his sister and his sister's husband and said, listen, this kid's not going to see 20. Like, he'll be lucky to see 18. He's not going to make it. And, you know, one of the things I love about Bobby, I talk about this in the show as well, is that he would take every obstacle and see it as a challenge to be overcome. And
mm-hmm.
he heard that and he said, okay, well, if I don't have much time, then I've got to make my mark as soon as possible and in every way that I can. And so whenever he had a song, he would treat that song like it was the last song on earth, and he had to make it as big and as much of a hit as he could.
Bobby Darin's life, as we said, was very short, but he lived a lot longer than most anticipated because
True.
I think it was his stubbornness, perhaps. And the stories I've heard from people that had worked with him is that he bucked the system every chance he got. He was told, you have to do this, you got to do it. He'd say, that's not the way I want to do it. and he would do it himself. And back in those days, the artist really didn't have a voice. Even Elvis, you know, was under the thumb of Colonel Tom. They didn't have a lot of freedom. You were told, this is what you're recording. This songwriter gave us this, and this is your arranger, and here's where you recorded the studio at Capitol Records, whatever. And you went in, you did your job dutifully, and you had a hit record, and the girl screamed. And that was pretty much it. Bobby was like Buddy Holly in some ways. Took hold of his own career, and that was not common. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's true. You know, Bobby was fortunate enough to be raised in a house that was full of music. His mom was a vaudeville retired vaudeville performer, and so she made sure that the house was full of music. And so he grew up wanting to play it, wanting to sing it, wanting to do everything with it. So I think that helped a lot, because his first in was writing music. He wrote he wrote music for a bunch of different artists, and just started to sing it because they needed to lay down demos, and so. A couple of people heard these demos and said, "Oh, well, you should actually sing as well." So he had kind of the skills to be able to write music as well as play music and sing music. And I think that, coupled with his boldness, made it possible for him to forge his own kind of career, because he wasn't dependent on anyone else. He didn't need someone to give him the songs. He didn't need someone to tell him how to do it. He said, "I'm going to make it all happen myself." And anytime someone told him he couldn't, he just chose to disagree and go his own way.
He was actually one of the first that kind of spearheaded where you could write your own songs. Back then, there was the Brill Building and Tin Pan Alley, and those were where the songwriters were, and they would hand the songs to a manager or an arranger, and then they would call in the artist they felt whose voice was appropriate for it. So many of the greats that we now call great performers, Neil Sedaka, Carole King, they all started as songwriters. Bobby kind of paved that road for them. Because he was one of the first to say, "I'm going to sing my own songs."
True.
And broke down that barrier a little bit. I didn't realize that he wrote as many songs as he had.
Yeah, he wrote quite an incredible amount of songs. And some of the songs that he wrote became bigger hits for other people than they did for him.
Is there a for instance?
Yeah, for instance, there's a song that I believe it's called A Simple Song of Freedom. I'm pretty sure I'm right about this, that he wrote, and then a folk musician named Tim Hardin recorded it, and his version was much more popular. But Bobby and he like traded back and forth, because Tim Hardin wrote a song called If I Were a Carpenter, and Bobby's version of that actually became one of Bobby's top 10 hits for his entire career, and he did much better for Bobby than it had done for Tim Hardin. But that's just one example where Bobby wrote a song, and then someone else saw the promise in that song and made it a little bit different and actually had a bigger hit with it.
All right, well, let's play that one. This is your treatment of If I Were a Carpenter, and Bobby wrote this. Is this a song that you can relate to? Is this a song that you enjoy in the show?
I do enjoy it in the show. You know, it's because, like you said, Bobby was such a lover of jazz, and he had hits in primarily jazz as well as some rock and roll. He didn't really get into folk until later in his career, and this was the only one that he really had a hit with. So for me, I like it because it's a complete turn in terms of the music we've been doing so far in the show, and it provides a nice mellow moment for the audience to kind of sit back and just receive him as more of a laid-back folk singer, which was something that was relatively new when he was doing it.
This is the song If I Were a Carpenter. More with Christopher on the other side.
Answer me, baby, yes I would. put you above me. If I were a miller at a mill wheel grinding, would you miss your color box, your soft shoes shining?
If I Were a Carpenter, a song written, applause, written by the late, great Bobby Darin, recorded by Tim Hardin, recorded there by Christopher Calais Jones, and he is the star of Bobby Darin, Bobby's Biggest Hits, which is coming to the Theater at the Center, 1040 Ridge Road in Munster, Indiana, and it's part of the Artist Lounge series. We've had Michael and Angela Ingersoll on the program before when she was doing the Judy Garland show. Michael in particular is the man behind all these wonderful tribute shows, these reviews that we're bringing to Munster. And this is the latest. It'll be there on June 16th, two performances, 3 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. And you can get your tickets at theateratthecenter.com. You have a website as well. Tell us about that.
I do, absolutely. It's www.christophercollegejones.com. You can also go to the website for the show, which is www.darrenshow.com. You can also find all the information, of course, on the Artist Lounge Live site. But the DarrenShow.com site is where I keep the information for the show. That we also recorded this album in January, which was such a thrill to be able to do and actually get this recorded and available for people. So it'll be for sale at the show on June 16th at the Theater at the Center. You can also purchase the album through the website if you wanted to do that. If you happen to not be in the immediate area, you can get it there. But one thing I want to talk about with the Theater at the Center, I just actually was there yesterday because they do a theatrical season, of course, throughout the year, and they've got their show Forever Platt.
Just had the guys on last Tuesday.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it was a great, great cast, great group of guys, and really enjoyed seeing the show. But I got to say, I hadn't experienced the space that before, and one of the things I loved about it is it's so intimate there. You know, you've got 400 seats there, but because it wraps around the stage, it really provides an intimate setting. There's only 7 rows, so every seat is actually a really great seat to see everything, and you really feel like you're part of the action. And for me as a performer, it was exciting to be in there because when you're in a space like that, you realize that you can be a little bit more intimate. You can be a little bit more folksy. You can actually have interactions with people because you're not playing a proscenium stage where you're presentational and you have to keep the fourth wall in place. You can actually talk to people and be a bit more comfortable. So I'm really looking forward to these particular shows. And if you haven't gotten your tickets yet, there isn't a bad seat in the house, and I would love to have you there.
Sightlines are wonderful. The acoustics in there are wonderful.
True.
And the stage is only, about 2.5 feet high?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're on eye level with a lot of people. You can step down. I've seen a lot of performers that have actually walked into the aisle and interacted with the audiences. And it is a beautiful facility. And it's a shame because a lot of people think they have to go to Chicago to see good theater and good performances. And this primarily is an Equity House.
Yes.
So you're seeing top shelf professionals. Nothing against community theater. I've got a lot of friends that do it, so no slings and arrows, please. But this is top shelf. These are professionals like yourself that have played all over the country, that have played in New York and on Broadway and all these different places.
Absolutely. You know, I'm fortunate enough to make my career a number of different ways. One of which is as an actor. And so my wife and I are both actors as well as singers, and so we're hoping to come down there for a show at some point in the near future. But it really is. It's a professional place. You've got great performers, great production values, and yeah, there isn't a bad seat in the house. I'm hoping to possibly have a little audience interaction for Darren coming up on June 16th, yeah, it's going to be a fun time.
How long have you been portraying Bobby Darin? When did Michael come to you and say, hey, you know what? You're the guy. We want to do a Bobby Darin show.
Well, you know what? There's a funny story about that. You want the inside scoop?
I'll tell us the truth.
You got it. Here we go. So Michael came to me and said, listen, I'm putting this together. I want you to do a show. I like you as a performer. You pick what you want to do. So I originally thought it'd be a really cool idea to talk about artists who, for whatever reason, had never kind of reached the height of Frank Sinatra, but were all in the same sort of world.
Al Martinos, people like that?
Yeah, or people who were close to his spot, but never quite as big, even people as far as in the Rat Pack, you know, like Dean Martin and so on. So I wanted to do a show called Standing in the Shadows of Frank, which was going to be a show featuring Dean Martin, Tony Bennett, and Bobby Darin, these three different Italian artists who all kind of were shooting for the same thing Frank was, but never quite became, you know, the godfather of jazz that Frank Sinatra became. So I wrote this entire show, and we were getting about a couple months away from, maybe 3 months away from presenting the show, and we just couldn't figure out how to make it look good on a poster, to be honest. We were like,
it's all about the visual.
Exactly. We're like, standing in the shadows of Frank. Are you going to sing Frank's songs? Well, no, it's no Frank Sinatra, but Frank's in the title. So it was just confusing. And so we thought, we've got to distill this. And so we said, Michael basically said, pick one. Which guy do you want to do? And I had been the most drawn into Bobby's story, to everything that kind of happened to him in his life, and frankly to his music, and the fact that our voices are similar. And there's a lot of similarities beyond that. You know, Bobby was exactly my height. He was 5'9". He was exactly my weight. He was 160 pounds. You know, his mother was a performer. My mother was a ballet dancer and performer. So all of these things I found out as I was creating this show that was going to feature three artists, and I thought, well, Bobby's the guy. We got to move forward with this. And that's kind of how we did it. And so I got a bunch more of his music. I put it in there. I crafted a lot of stories to kind of piece it together and created a great kind of hour and a half plus of entertainment.
And how long now has it been since you guys put this together?
Yeah, so the first show was July of 2016. Now, bear in mind, I was still touring with my group Under the Street Lamp up until the end of this past year, 2017. So we had to kind of pick and choose when I could do Bobby Darin dates. So in that time, I did about five or six shows. And now that I have more availability, I'm going to be doing it a bunch more. But it's been a thing for about 2 years.
Now, you were at the last Street Lamp show at the Star, correct?
I was, yes.
I thought, yeah, I was there, and I could have swore you were there. I've seen you guys so many times.
Sure.
You're no longer with the group. We were talking off air. You kind of still step in once in a while when needed, but
yeah, I've let the guys know that I'm available to fill in, and they've used me once to be able to do that. And they, every now and then, they'll reach out and see if we got a date available. But I wanted to move away from it, because there were things that I was working on. This being a prime one of them, that I wanted to see how far they could go, and I wanted to pour more energy into them. And you know, Under the Street Lamp was a full time commitment. It was it had to be our first priority, and it also took me away from home a lot. I've got a 5-year-old girl at home. I've got a wife, and I just wanted to have a little more time with them, and also to be able to pour into the projects that were kind of more consuming. And the guys were very understanding. They said, "We get it. We know you want to do these things. You're welcome to go with our blessing." And I was very grateful to them for that.
It's interesting. The whole Street Lamp concept was interesting because here are a bunch of guys from different touring companies of Jersey Boys. Mm-hmm. Road ones, stationary ones that you had residencies at, and you somehow found each other and created this group out of the ashes, I guess you'd say, of the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
And now you're all springing into your own careers from that. It was like a nice transitional period.
Absolutely.
The Menudo of vocal groups or something. I don't know. It's like you come in for a while, you graduate, you move on.
Yeah. You know, it's I think for a few of us, that's been the way it's been. You know, we had a guy named Michael Cuno who was in the group, and he was in for just a few years and then moved on. And he was actually just in the Chicago area doing Jesus Christ Superstar at the Lyric.
That's right.
And now he's headed back to New York. But
the girls loved him.
Yes.
Oh.
Absolutely.
I don't know how you guys kept up with him.
He was a dreamy, dreamy dreamboat.
Yeah.
And we knew it, you know. So I was glad to get rid of him, so that there was a little bit more, you know, attractiveness to go around. But so he was the first one to kind of come in and do that. You know, the remaining member from the very beginning, Sean Wiley, who's in Under the Street Lamp, I think it's he's the most suited for the group, and I think it's something he actually wants to do for as long as he can. You know, he loves doing it. It's, you know, we've all, you know, had our own pains in saying goodbye to him and to the group and him to us. So I think he's probably going to end up staying with it for a while. But for the rest of us, it was an incredible experience. It was a great learning experience. Mm-hmm. You know, it was participating in the music world in a way that we never had before, because we were primarily Broadway type, you know, theater performers. And to learn what it was like to create music and record albums and tour on the road was a huge education. And I think all of that informs choices when doing a show like Darren, where you're talking about the musician, what it was like to be a touring musician in that period, and what it is like now, and how the music industry works. I think all of that kind of just gives a greater depth to performance and makes mm-hmm. for a more interesting show.
I think it's interesting for those of us of a certain age that can look back and live through the 60s and the rock and roll era, that it was such a polarizing opposite. There was rock and roll, and then there was the Broadway, Blue Hairs, you know, that, oh, that's bad music. That's not real music, you know. And now we're seeing all these great rock and roll performers become Broadway topics. I mean, the Jersey Boys, Million Dollar Quartet, Elton John, Carole King have all had their own stuff. We're seeing rock and roll. I mean, rock came to Broadway years ago with Superstar and Hair and things like that. But we're seeing these artists who were dismissed by the upper crust, the New Yorkers, so to speak. And now you're the hottest thing on the ticket up there in the Great White Way.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a fantastic point, because I think in the 40s, 50s, 60s, even a little into the 70s, there was this great kind of camaraderie between the pop rock world and Broadway. There were a lot of people, you know, a show would come out on Broadway, and the top two songs of that show would immediately be recorded by several different pop artists to see who could make it a hit. And for a period in like the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, it was kind of like, well, you stay over there, Broadway, mm-hmm. and the pop rock world will stay over here. Then you have, you know, you have people like on American Idol, when a voice, you know, sounded too vibrato or something, you say, well, it sounds too Broadway, you know, like as if it was a bad thing. And now we see there's a lot more crossover happening. Broadway is recognizing the allure that comes with doing a pop rock sort of catalog. You've got shows like SpongeBob on Broadway right now that uses music from a ton of different pop rock artists, and then you have a show like Hamilton that, you know, was out a couple years ago, that is actually doing what Broadway used to do, which is getting a lot of, you know, they created the whole mixtape album from Hamilton, which all of these artists who are contemporaries said, yeah, I want to be covering this music, I want to be doing this music, which is how it used to be. And so I'm hoping that this is leading to a new resurgence of kind of just a mishmash of collaboration from both worlds, because I honestly think that created one of the best cultural times we had in our country, and I would love to see elements of that recreated.
Did you grow up wanting to be a rock star, or did you have ambitions of being a Broadway star?
Man, that is a good question. You know, it's funny. This is something I share with Bobby, which came out as I was reading some of the books about him. But I grew up kind of wanting to be an actor first, primarily. But I loved singing. So my way into being an actor was through singing. I would do a bunch of musicals. I'd do some plays too, but a bunch of musicals. And then that led into the Jersey Boys world, which led into Darren and Under the Street Lamp. For me, the fact that I really wanted to be an actor, I think part of the reason I wanted to be an actor is because I think anyone who is an artist remembers their first times that they were transported. Mm-hmm. And for me, I remember going to a movie theater with my dad, and the lights would go down, and a story would start, and I would be taken away to that world. And it was also, you know, the most precious time I had with my father, you know, who I love dearly. He's in Hawaii. For me, it was a very special time. And so that ingrained in me as an artist, I want to do this when I get older. But now I'm able to take that to the types of shows that I do. And my goal is to really transport someone, you know. If you're having a rough day, I want you to be able to escape that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you haven't had a good cry in a while and you need too. I'd like to provide a moment or two that you can, you know. If you just want to laugh, I like to provide those moments as well. And it's really my goal to kind of take you out of where you are, let you have an escape and an experience, and hopefully go back into your life richer and more excited to reengage.
Whether you were a fan of the Four Seasons or a fan of Bobby Darin, you did that for so many people. Those songs matter. They're the soundtrack of lives. And you recreate that.
Thank you. That's,
so,
yeah, that's
I think
my
that's
goal.
I think that's a gift. That's a blessing that you can bring to people. Speaking of both of those iconic roles, there is a version of "Can't Take My Eyes Off You," of course, a big Frankie Valli Four Seasons song that you do as Bobby Darin. And Bobby actually did this song, but
didn't
record it.
It's true.
Tell me the story.
I have not seen this arrangement recorded anywhere, so I may be fortunate enough to be able to have the first one recorded out there. But so Bobby Darin, toward the end of his career, did a show on NBC called The Bobby Darin Show. I did it for a season, and the ratings were great. It was a great fit for him. And Can't Take My Eyes Off You was a big hit for Frankie Valli at the time. And Bobby wanted to do a version of it, and Bobby was always tinkering with other versions. He was always taking songs and speeding them up or making them more jazzy, and he did the same thing with this song. And I heard it and I thought, well, A, I have to do it because I come from the Jersey Boys world, but B, I love it just because his arrangement is so much fun. And if you're a fan of the Frankie Valli version, you'll be amazed at how different it is and yet how much it stands up to the original.
So this is the version that you heard on the TV show that Bobby did.
That I heard it and I got some friends together and we made an arrangement that pretty much mimicked it, and it's the one I do in the show.
All right, this is it. Can't Take My Eyes Off You, done Bobby style.
You so much. At long last, love has arrived, and I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. Apart in the way that I stare, there's nothing else to compare. The sight of you leaves me weak. There are no words left to speak. But if you feel like I feel, please let me know that it's real. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. In me when I say, oh, when I say, oh, pretty baby, now that I have found you, stay, oh, pretty baby, I never ever go away, and let me love you, baby. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. You're just too good to be true. Cannot take my eyes off you. No way.
Now that's a definitely different arrangement of a Frankie Valli classic. It's got all that finger snapping, finger popping, toe tapping, hipster style that Darin was known for. My guest today is Christopher Calais Jones. He is playing Bobby Darin on June 16th at Theater at the Center in Munster. It's not just a bunch of songs thrown in there. It's the story of Bobby Darin, and you kind of tell it chronologically, don't you, in a way?
I do a bit, yeah. I have a couple little cheats in there just because I like to wrap up some storylines before going into others. But basically, yeah, I tell it from the beginning of him kind of hitting with – I give a little backstory and then how he kind of hit on the scene and then go a little bit into his romantic life and kind of what the later life was like.
Speaking of his romantic life
– yes.
I understand. I know they collaborated, but I understand that him and Connie Francis had a bit of a thing.
They did.
Okay, how did that that work?
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Connie Francis because when I mentioned earlier he wrote for people before mm-hmm. He wrote for Connie Francis.
Okay.
And so they were in you know, close collaboration for a little while when he was very young. I want to say, you know, 16, 17. And he was head over heels for her. And she was in love with him, but she had a very protective Italian father who did not want her paired up with another musician, least of which Bobby Darin, who was this kid who was kind of from the wrong side of the tracks mm-hmm. and rough around the edges and someone that, on the face of it, most fathers might not want for their daughters. And so he let them know very clearly that this was not going to be a thing. And Bobby eventually said, listen, Connie, will you run away with me and we'll find a way to make it work? And she couldn't do it. She said, you know, I can't, you know, she was scared of what her father would do and didn't want to have that rift in her family. And so Bobby, to protect himself, basically just had to cut it off.
Wow.
But it's, you know, there are many who theorize that they would have been a couple if she had been willing, and it would have been a completely different story than who he eventually ended up with.
That's a lot like Pierangeli and James Dean. They had that star-crossed love thing going on, and
Absolutely.
Her mom said, you're going to marry, you know, Vic Damone.
Yep.
And like it, which broke Jimmy Dean's heart. I mean, he never really recovered from her, from what I'm told by people that knew him. Bobby Darin, we were talking off air. I personally think Bobby Darin would have been the next Frank Sinatra had he lived, and not so much emulating Frank, but because he had Frank's attitude, his drive, his charisma.
Yeah.
He could command a room. Bobby Darin, you mentioned off air also that Bobby didn't want to be Frank, but he wanted to be bigger than Frank.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty bold statement, but I think he could have lived that.
Yeah. And he was, you know, don't get me wrong, Bobby was full of bold statements. Like, that's how he lived his life. And he was, when he won the Grammy Award for Best New Artist for Splish Splash, when that came out, he said, I want to be bigger than Frank. And he said it publicly, and he said it to
wow.
the media outlets. So he was a guy who was not scared to let his desires and his goals be known.
And that song really did not define who he was.
No.
It was almost like a novelty song.
It was. You know, he recorded that song and two others in one session in a night. And one of the other songs became another one of his top 10 hits, Queen of the Hop, which most people recognize if they hear but aren't really sure until they hear the music. But he recorded those two in one session, and they both kind of hit the top of the charts, which helped get him the purchase that he wanted to be, you know, a viable impact in the music industry. And then once he had that foothold, he began to do the music that he really wanted to do, which was more along the Sinatra, Dean Martin, swinger, jazz mm-hmm. sort of line. Yeah.
And as I mentioned, I've worked a few times with Roger McGuinn from the Byrds, and he worked closely as a member of Bobby's band, and they wrote a few things, I guess, together from what I was told. And Bobby was very much a folk singer, too.
Mm-hmm.
He loved it, but he never really recorded much. And we mentioned If I Were a Carpenter, but he didn't really have that part of his recording career, did he?
He did some. He had a couple albums that came out toward the end of his career that were folk oriented. He had some dramatic things happen toward the end of his life, and he used the time to kind of deal with these things. To go, he has an album called Songs from Big Sur, where he went to Big Sur, California, and mm-hmm. basically spent about, I think, 8 or 9 months there in a trailer, living very simply and writing folk music. And the album is the songs that came from that. There are some that saying if that, you know, if he'd been able to continue in his career, basically, he could have made a career in any number of musical paths, and a lot of people said that his folk music was a way that he could have made a future there. It just didn't have enough time to do it.
And, of course, he died very young, 1973. At that time in pop music history, it was the era of the singer-songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
The Jackson Browns and people like that were all coming to fruition, and Bobby would have fit right in at the pioneering aspect of that. He was also very involved with Robert Kennedy.
I
think that may have had something of a social impact on his musical writing.
Yeah, I think it did. You know, like a lot of performers, you spend the early part of your career just hoping that someone's going to give you the chance to do what you want to do so badly. I know that I did. And then when you get a certain amount of success there, you start to think, well, is this the only way, or are there other ways that I want to make an impact with my life? And Bobby, because he really reached the pinnacle pretty quickly in his career in the music world, as well as in a couple others, he decided, I want to make an impact in a way that I think is more meaningful. And so he looked toward politics. And so he stumped for Robert Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was on the road with him and singing for him and opening up and helping out. And when he was assassinated, it was a big blow to Bobby personally. That coupled with some things in his personal life was what made him kind of draw back for a while and take a more wistful, kind of inward-looking approach with his music that kind of birthed that folk era for him.
Do you think he would have gone into politics, being as boisterous and colorful as he was?
I do. I do think he would have. You know, I think he, because he'd had, there were some secrets from his childhood that he wasn't aware of that eventually came out, and we can go into those. He drew back from what would have been a political career toward the end of his life, and I think if he'd lived longer, we would have gotten past an era where those things meant so much. But at the time, those were pretty damning things that could have really hurt his career. So,
and things today that really wouldn't matter.
Not as much, no. You know, the woman he thought was his mother was actually his grandmother, and mm-hmm. the woman he'd kind of been raised with as his sister, his older sister, was his mother. But it was a period where, like, he was a bastard child for this girl who was 16 at the time, and that would have had a stain on both of them, particularly in that era. And so his sister knew that would come out if he went into a political career. So he had actually told his sister, I want to be a politician. And she said, okay, well, then it's time you knew these things. And that really rocked his world. The woman he thought of as his mother was not. The woman that he thought of as his sister was not. And that's when he kind of withdrew for a good period.
That had a really mess with his head.
It did. It did. For a significant period. He really kind of went away for about a full year, which for him, you know, is about a decade, because
right.
he would produce in a year what most people do in a decade.
It's like Lennon's Lost Weekend.
Uh-huh.
1973, we lost Bobby Darin, age of 37. Again, he had suffered throughout life with rheumatic fever, and it took a toll on his body. And I remember my sister was a huge fan, and her being just devastated. He had died, I think, on the operating table following heart surgery.
Yeah, it was just the day or two after it had happened. Basically, he a series of antibiotics you need to take before having surgery. It was actually dental surgery,
oh.
but it was complications due to his heart. His heart had issues since the rheumatic fever as a kid, so he always had to take antibiotics anytime he was going to do any even routine surgery. So he was having a dental surgery, he needed to have these antibiotics for his heart before doing the dental surgery, and hadn't taken them and got an infection. And for his weakened immune system and weakened heart, it just overwhelmed his system, and
He was right at the pinnacle of the next crossroads at
yeah.
that point. Let's go back. We played Splish Splash, which was the first single. And it's interesting, 1954-55, he met a guy that later became known as a guru of hard rock. And he kind of steered Bobby into his career, and it's Don Kirshner.
Mm-hmm.
Don Kirshner's rock concert. We all grew up in the 70s watching that at midnight. And Don Kirshner helped steer him. I understand they had a falling out later. And then he met Ahmet Ertegun at Atlantic Records. Atlantic was very much a jazz label.
Mm-hmm.
Ertegun was a big fan of jazz. And he recorded Bobby. And oddly enough, Splish Splash was the first single. I would think that with Atlantic, they would have steered him in a more proper direction. But you mentioned Queen of the Hop was another song from that session. What's the story on this song before we play it?
Sure. Well, this song doesn't have a bunch of story behind it, as far as I know. The Splish Splash they knew was going to be the hit in this session, but this other song was happening, and they tried a couple other artists on it, and it just wasn't working. And so Bobby took it on, and there was just so much magic happening in that session, in that studio. It was over 90 minutes he recorded three songs, which was pretty unheard of, and two of them became his top 10 hits, Queen of the Hop and Splish Splash. So I think for me, the story behind this song is that it just benefited from the magic of that session. Like, he did Splish Splash, and then things were flowing so well, he did this song, and it just became a hit.
I had never heard this song until I heard your version of it on this album. So maybe that's the case with a lot of listeners. This is Queen of the Hop. This is Christopher's version of a classic Bobby Darin tune.
To Julie and your Peggy Sue, you can keep your Miss Molly and your Mary Lou. When it comes to the chicken or a doing the bop, I got a girl they call the Queen of the Hop. Well, I love my queen. Do you know who I mean? The sweet little 16. Yes, that's my queen. Well, she wears short shorts and those rock and roll shoes. You ought to see her dance to the Yellow Dog Blues. She's my sugar time baby, I'm her lollipop. And everybody knows I love my Queen of the Hop. Well, I love my queen. Do you know who I mean? Sweet little 16. Yes, that's my queen. Well, she tunes in the bandstand every day to watch the kids a-dancing across the USA. She don't care about a thing except in rock and roll. My baby drives me crazy when she does the show, yeah. Oh, well, she tunes in the bandstand every day to watch the kids a-dance across the USA. She don't care about a thing except in rock and roll. My baby drives me crazy when she does the show. Well, I love my queen. Do you know who I mean? Sweet little 16. Yes, that's my queen.
Going out to all you young lasses that were the queen of the hop back in the glory days when there were record hops and sock hops. That's what they used to be called. Now, I don't know what they call them anymore. I miss that term, sock hop. Old rock and roll term. Bobby Darin is the subject. Darin is coming to the theater at the center on Saturday, June 16th. Two performances, 3 p.m., 7:30 p.m. And my guest is Christopher Calais-Jones, and he is the star of Bobby Darin. And this is a one-man show primarily.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a one-man show. It's me just singing all of Bobby's hits, but we do have a live band.
That's why I said primarily.
That's right.
You have a killer group behind you. Tell us a little about them.
So, yes, we have six people behind me that are all way more talented than I am. We've got a trumpet player. We've got a trombone player. We've got a saxophone player, because you got to have a full horn section if you're doing Bobby Darin songs. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a jazz rhythm section. So we've got piano, bass, and drums.
Wow. Now, how much rehearsal time went into this? We had talked, you started about July was of 2016?
Yeah, July of 2016
was your first performance.
First performance. And
how
so,
much time went into it before you felt confident to be able to go up there and be an icon like Bobby Darin?
Sure. Well, I benefited in this particular show by using primarily all of Bobby's arrangements, because you want it to sound like Bobby. So I had a good friend of mine, Chuck Larkin, who did all the rhythm arrangements for the piano, the drums, and the bass. And then and my friend Brian Fritz, who is an incredible saxophone player out of St. Louis, did all the horn arrangements, and we got them together. And honestly, these guys are such pros that every time we do this show, we basically put it together in about 1 2- to 5-hour rehearsal, and then put it up. And
that's crazy.
I benefit now in that some of the guys have played the show in the past since I've done it a few times. But even in the original one, you know, we get them together, we do it for about 3 to 5 hours. They've got the charts in front of them, so they're, you know, they don't have to memorize all of it.
Right.
And I just have to make sure I know what I'm doing, and off to the races we go.
Wow. You recorded, the songs we're playing today were recorded at Mercury Theater in Chicago. This is a full-fledged live show, and we've edited out some of the dialogue on the songs, but you tell the story on the album as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's pretty much soup to nuts what you're going to see on stage.
Yeah, it's abridged because on stage we do a little over 90 minutes of full material and show with the stories and the songs. There will be songs that are not on the album that you will see in the show. Not many, but a few. We basically chose the best ones to put on the album. But yeah, we did. It was quite an experience to do the show at the Mercury Theater in January, and had a bunch of people come out for it. And you can hear them in all that wonderful, wild, completely unwarranted but wonderful applause on the album. I was certainly thankful to have such an enthusiastic group show up, and really it turned out really well.
You have a couple of shows. If you go to your website, give it again.
Sure. The website is www.darrenshow.com.
If you go to the website, there are a series of shows booked in addition to the one here in Munster we're talking about today. Many of them are sold out and have been sold out in the past.
Yes.
Are you anticipating a sellout for Munster as well?
I'm certainly hoping for one. You know, I don't want to come across as too overconfident. But one thing I've been surprised by since starting this, since July of 2016, is how many Closet Darren fans there are. You know, they're just people who loved Bobby, loved his music, and agree that he went too soon. And when they find out that there's an artist who's celebrating his catalog, they come out of the woodwork. And it's been sold out pretty much, you know, like 90% of the time that we've done this. I think that there may be some factor that has to do with me doing it or anything like that, but the main factor has got to be that people love his music and want to hear a live band paying homage and doing it justice.
Now, how long do you see yourself doing Bobby Darin? You're a very fluid, you know, guy. I mean, you seem to go from projects to projects, and any actor and performer doesn't want to be locked into that one role. But you do this so well. It is still fresh. But looking ahead, is there like, okay, I'm going to do this for 5 years. I'm going to do this for 10 years. I'm going to do this for a year.
That's a great question. It's one that I'm considering pretty strongly right now because I love doing it so much. I definitely foresee myself doing this for the next at least 3 to 5 years.
Okay.
I don't want it to turn into this sort of thing where I start to look older than Bobby did,
right.
to a degree where it's just you can't allow yourself to be transported as much at the show. But I've got some time before that happens. So for me, I'm just really enjoying doing it right now. I also have the pride of ownership. You know, this is something that I kind of created from the bottom up, and I really enjoy doing it. I really take pride in kind of making it the best I can. I take the music very seriously, but when you come to the show, you'll see I don't take myself very seriously at all.
Okay.
So I poke a little fun at myself definitely give more of the information from his life that people are interested in that they may not know.
Now, have you – obviously, it's still relatively fresh, about a year old, but have you had any feedback at all from Bobby's family or friends that knew Bobby that saw the show?
That's a great question. You know, I've had feedback from people who have seen Bobby live, and that's been wonderful. People said, you know, he was one of my first concerts, and seeing you took me right back, and it was so wonderful to see someone who was paying homage to his music, but also did it to a degree that I was able to kind of allow myself to believe I was back seeing it the first time. I've reached out to his son, Dodd Darren, in Los Angeles when I was recording the album, just to let him know I was doing it. If he happened to be in Chicago, I would love to set him up with tickets, and he just didn't have plans to be in the area. So now that I have the album out, I'm going to reapproach him. And
did you get any feedback from him?
No, the only feedback I got was, we're so happy that you're covering his catalog.
Oh.
And you know, go with our blessing, and I was very thankful for that. I'm hoping that I'll have a chance to actually meet with him at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a busy man, and honestly, his catalog is coming back into the light in a lot of different ways. You know, there's a musical right now about his life that's been featured in Australia that they're trying to bring to the U.S. There was a concert version of his life that was done in New York recently that they were tooling to possibly be a different sort of Broadway musical. So, you know, there's a lot of interest there that mm-hmm. I know they're trying to kind of bring it back into the forefront. Of course, there was the Kevin Spacey movie that came out a bit ago, but I think they're toying with TV series.
And I think Kevin Spacey, I mean, I know he's not a hot topic. Well, he is a hot topic, but not for good reasons. But Kevin did a really good job playing Bobby.
I agree. I thought
that was one of the best docu-series, movie, TV things ever made.
Yeah, I thought he did a fantastic job. You know, I thought it was clear that he was a fan who also took it very seriously, did the music well. I thought it was a great call for him to sing it himself. I thought that he had a good voice to carry it, and he obviously studied the way that Bobby sang, and I thought he did a fantastic job, and I was grateful to have it as a resource as I was doing this.
The movie we were talking about is Beyond the See, if you have it in your local video store or you're on your Netflix or whatever, do check it out. It is a good job. The plays you're talking about, where they're bringing the musical back from Australia and New York, is this something you see yourself throwing your hat in the ringer and saying, I want to audition for that?
Possibly. You know, I have mentioned before that I love, you know, I love acting. I love being on the stage portraying characters. And with this concert, I tell stories from his life. I don't really play Bobby. So that would certainly be something that would appeal to me. But, you know, we'll have to just see what the future holds. I definitely am hoping that I can get this album to Dodd and to his team and partner with them in any way that I can and be of any help that I can be in terms of bringing any work that they have over here stateside. You know, maybe bring the musical to Chicago or something like that. Mm-hmm. I know that there's been a resurgence of interest in a lot of characters from this era. You know, there's that TV series Sun Records that just started that covers with Sam Phillips and Elvis and the whole team out of Sun Records. And I think that they're hoping to capitalize on the interest in that sort of thing with a Bobby Darin vehicle. So, I, of course, as a performer, it'd be fun to be in the running for anything like that. But at this point, I'm having so much fun doing these concerts that regardless what happens, I'm pretty blessed.
Now, just to jump back real quick, you had played Frankie Valli in Jersey Boys. Did you ever get any feedback from Frankie?
I did get feedback from Frankie.
Okay.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough. So I did the national tour. We did it for about 5 months in San Francisco and then moved the show to L.A. for 3 months. And soon after I got to L.A., I got a call from the producers. And they said, hey, Chris, Frankie Valli would like to meet with you to talk about his music. Would you be willing to meet with him? So, of course, I said, listen, I'm way too busy. I don't know if I could do it. No, I jumped at the chance. I hopped in my car, drove out to Calabasas, where he's got a nice home there. And he welcomed me into his kitchen. He gave me some blueberry muffins, and we talked for about an hour and a half just about his life and the music. I still have a recording of that conversation, mm-hmm. which every now and then I'll revisit. And he was very generous and gracious about it. One of the things he said, which I need to credit him now that I'm doing this, is he said, you know, you've got a good voice. You could actually do this. You could tour in the concert world and make a living that way if it was something you're interested in, which is one reason why I want to pour this time into you. And at that point, I was only concerned with being an actor. You know, I was playing Frankie in a show, and I imagined I would just go on doing more theater. Little did I know that just a hop, skip, and a jump down the road, I'd be doing Under the Street Lamp, and then coming out of that, I would be doing this show celebrating the life and music of Bobby Darin. So in a lot of ways, Frankie Valli was the kernel that started that whole fire for me.
Do you think of yourself more as a singer now than an actor? Is there one versus the other that you like more? I mean, even though you're doing more singing now?
Sure. I think of myself however is necessary to pay the bills.
Okay.
I'm kidding. No, I definitely feel that my experience now has led to this career in the concert world that I'm incredibly grateful for. So I love doing it. But part of the reason I'm grateful to live in a city like Chicago is there's opportunities to do things outside of that all the time. And one of the reasons I moved out of Under the Street Lamp, which was more all-consuming, was to be able to have more ownership over those things. So I now am able to kind of set my schedule a bit more and do these concerts during a period of the year. And I really enjoy that and really have a blast, and then you know, kind of get the acting itch out of my mm-hmm. system if I need to in another part of the year. And so I'm grateful that I've kind of hit this period in my career where I'm a little older and a little more seasoned, where I can make those choices for myself and set my own kind of life that makes me happy.
Time to play another song. Again, this is Chris doing some Bobby Darin, and we were just talking about the Kevin Spacey movie Beyond the Sea. So this is one of his biggest hits.
It is, yes.
So this is Beyond the Sea, done by Christopher Calais Jones.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. She's far beyond the stars, she's near beyond the moon. Soon we'll meet beyond the shore. We'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing. Just as before, happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing, no more sailing, so long sailing, bye-bye sailing.
Love that ending on that.
Yeah, that's fun. I did take that from Bobby from a live show.
Beyond the Sea, Christopher Calais Jones is playing Bobby Darin on Saturday, June 16th. Two shows, 3 p.m., 7:30 p.m. at the Theater Center in Munster. Beautiful venue, 410
yeah, like
seats.
10, yeah, yeah.
Not a bad sight line in the house. Acoustics are great. If you've never been there, this might be just the show to come see, because you'll get a chance to hear just how wonderful it is and see how wonderful it is. And you, you've been doing this for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a typical size venue for the show?
It's definitely the size that we've done most often, and I'm grateful for that, because it's just the right amount of size. You want enough people in the crowd that you kind of have that group cathartic sort of experience, where mm-hmm. you feel people next to you enjoying the music, and you don't feel like it's just a few. But at the same time, it's small enough that it's still intimate, that you feel like you're part of something special. It's, you know, it's basically the big stage version of singing in your living room for your family. You know,
okay.
So I love it.
Now, we talked about the fact that a lot of the people that come and comment to you about how much they loved Bobby Darin and the music meant something to them. In the beginning, I said this was an important show because it is bringing this classic catalog to a new generation.
Mm-hmm.
And are you seeing a lot of younger folks coming out and saying, well, like Jose sitting right here, I know these songs. I didn't know that was Bobby Darin.
Right.
Are you seeing that happen? Are kids coming out, and when I say kids, I mean anyone under 25.
Sure.
Coming out and turning on to Bobby. Are you bringing that legacy to them?
Definitely. You know, I see kind of a mix of younger people coming to the show. Some are people who just love the music from the 50s and 60s. It just happens to be – I always am entranced when I see these kids basically who are in their, you know, late teens, early 20s are like, I heard this music at home and it became my favorite kind of music. And so I like to come out and support it, which we definitely have had some of those. And others are coming with family members. You know, they got their parents or their grandparents and they come and then they're like, oh, I didn't know I knew these songs. And now I know much more about this guy, and I want to hear more of his catalog and delve in more deeply. Thankfully, because I do the show at venues like this where there's theatrical seasons, you get a lot of overlap there. So you get people who enjoy theater who say, "Oh, I'll come to a concert," and then they learn about the artist, and then they get drawn in that way. So we do have a mix of younger people that have come from a variety of different backgrounds to experience it.
And even though it is a concert, it is still theatrical because you're telling the story. There is some dialogue. Yeah. And there's a lot of interaction. A lot of history. You learn a lot of things.
Absolutely. And I can't help myself because I'm a performer. So, you know, when I get into a story, I get into it and I enjoy it. So there is a theatrical element to it while still not taking myself very seriously. But yes, it has a theatrical arc. So you're not just hearing, you know, a song and then a bunch of aimless talking. You're hearing a song. I'm guiding you into what the next song's about possibly or what's happening in his life while it's happening or ways that his life is similar or different from mine. You know, one of the reasons that I love celebrating the music of Bobby Darin is because in terms of how we approach the world, we're very different. He was bold. Like he would, it was more important to him to make an impact than to consider other people's feelings first. You know, it just he had a job to do, and it was the most important thing to do. And you know, if you were going to get your feelings hurt on the way, you know, I'm sorry, but I got a job to do. I'm the completely opposite. I enter a room and I want to make sure everyone's okay. No one's upset. Is everyone all right? Am I behaving appropriately? So I love approaching this music and approaching him in his life because it gives me a little bit more boldness just in the doing of it. And I've been able to bring some of that to my life, and I'm grateful to him for that.
Now, if I remember right, Bobby got a lot of the boldness from his mother. Because his mother was a take-no-crap kind of gal.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And he got that from her. So he spoke his mind and stood his ground. He was raised by a showbiz mom. Mm-hmm. She was in vaudeville. Yep. Your mom was a dancer.
Yep. Also a take-no-prisoners kind of mom.
Different kind of attitude with you, though. Tell me about your life and how you came to embrace this. I mean, at what point did you say, Christopher, this will be a good job. You know, I'm going to take this serious. I mean, were you involved in the high school usual ways to get in? I mean,
yeah. Well, you know, I was. I've been singing since I was a tyke. You know, before my voice even changed, I was at a school that had a boys' choir, and so I was a boy soprano until my voice didn't change until the ninth grade. I was a late bloomer, so I was singing boy soprano until then, which is something I talked about a lot when I was in the Jersey Boys world because basically I had to turn back into a boy soprano to sing Frankie Valli music. But yeah, I've been singing since I was a little kid. My parents had always had music playing in the house. It was mainly two influences, though. They would have musical theater, which I was very thankful to them for. The Camelot with Robert Goulet was always playing in our house, and hearing that big booming voice, I just thought that was magical. And then also my mom, when she would clean the house, like a lot of people do, you know, they'll put on music to escape. That's why, you know, people will put on some high impact music when they work out or some, you know, when they're doing something they may not want to be doing so that they can kind of get away and do what they need to. And my mom, every time she had to clean the house, she just did not like cleaning the house. So she would put on Motown music. And I remember one particular song always was on the playlist when she was cleaning the house. It was called I Got the Music in Me,
which Kiki D?
Kiki D song. Okay. Yeah, I know. And I didn't even know who Kiki D was. And later when I learned what Motown was, I still, like, Kiki D was kind of on the fringes.
Yeah, very
of that.
Fringe.
So I still didn't know. And then, but this song, I remember very clearly from being a child, and it was kind of for me that was the song that typified where my mom came from growing up in the Detroit area. So I had that music on one side, and then I had music theater with Camelot and these great old classic musicals on the other side. And then whenever we were in the car, you know, I grew up in a pretty conservative family, so it was always like the 50s and 60s station. So with those three influences, I shouldn't be surprised that I ended up being in a group that kind of was a retro rock 50s and 60s group, and now I'm celebrating the music of Bobby Darin like I am.
And it's interesting, we talked about how you were inspiring younger generations and introducing them to this. Under the Street Lamp did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The music, a lot of people says, well, I know the songs, but I couldn't tell you it was the Temptations, Four Tops, you know, Righteous Brothers, whoever did it.
Right.
But they knew the songs.
Right.
Did the four of you, and I know there's been other members in there, but when you formed it, did the four of you, were you that aware of who these artists were? Or were you the same kind of people that come to the show? It's like, I knew the songs, but didn't know anything about them.
It was kind of a mix, you know. Being in Jersey Boys gave us an education. You know, we wanted to, of course, know the music of the Four Seasons, but we also wanted to know what was happening around the Four Seasons so that we could be educated performers and actors so that we could portray things the way that we should. You know,
mm-hmm.
we took great pride in the work that we did. So we did learn during that time a lot of these different artists that went with the different songs, but there were still surprises to us. And there were, you know, we had a loyal and wonderful fan base when we were doing Under the Street Lamp, and it's still going on, that would come to us and say, did you know about this song? This song was meaningful to me. And then we would bring that to the group and find out that someone else's mom really loved that song, or it was a song we just didn't know about. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're like, oh, well, this song really did have an impact for a lot of people.
So we're adding it in.
Let's do it, and let's add it in, and let's learn about it. So yeah, we had a lot of those sort of experiences.
Your mom was a dancer, and you do, at least you did with Under the Street Lamp, a lot of choreography, a la Temptations. Do you still do a lot of dancing in Bobby Darin? Because he was kind of a jazzy tap kind of guy.
He was. He was kind of a jazzy tap guy. But also, due to his health problems later in his career, but to some extent throughout, he couldn't do a bunch of dance numbers in a row.
Because he couldn't breathe.
Yeah, he couldn't breathe. So he actually, toward the last few years of his career, he had oxygen waiting for him off stage whenever he did a live show. But he was a capable and accomplished dancer. So I do try to suggest him so that people can kind of be taken away. So I move my hips around. I dance a little bit in the show, but it's not a fully dance through show, but it's definitely going to be something that gives you the feel for who he was.
One of the songs that we would be remiss not to play is probably one of the most popular Bobby Darin songs, is Mack the Knife. And we were talking off air about how he could take a horrible story and make you love it and dance to it.
Yeah.
Mack the Knife is a prime example, and I know you talk about that in the show. But why don't you tell us a little bit about Mack the Knife? I understand this is not a song. It became his biggest hit, probably, but
yeah.
It was not a song that anyone wanted him to record.
No, you know, I think it takes a unique person to hear this song and say, I love it and I want to make it a hit. And Bobby was that unique person. You know, he would whatever the things that sparked his interest, he would pour his heart into and make hits, and this was no exception. Now, this song is about a very questionable person and about a questionable activity. And so when he recorded it, even after he'd done it and everyone could hear what a great song it was, radio personalities didn't want to play it. They thought it was too scandalous
dark.
And too
yeah.
dark. And so he talked to his friend Dick Clark even, and Dick said, listen, Bobby, this song is not going to be a hit. And in fact, it's awful. You should just forget about this one. I mean, it was great. He went in the studio and did it, but it's awful. Don't do it. And similar to the story of Jersey Boys, where Frankie Valli believed in Can't Take My Eyes Off You and believed it could be a hit, even though it was a different type of song for him and for his audience, Bobby knew this song was a hit in his heart. And so he pushed it and had his team push it. And the rest is history. It was his best hit ever.
Wow. Is this a fun one for you to perform?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's fun on a number of different levels. It's fun because, A, it's just a fun song, and he does a great version of it. But because people expect it and know it's one of his hits, you mm-hmm. also kind of are playing off of that. So you feel the anticipation of the audience. And then once you go into those first few lyrics, everyone's there for the ride, and it's just a blast.
All right. This is one of Bobby Darin's biggest. You know it. You love it. Feel free to sing along with Christopher Calais-Jones as we listen to him live from the Mercury Theater.
Oh, the shark babe has such teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old MacKeith, babe, and he keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, where's old MacKeith, babe? So there's never, never a trace of red. You know on that sidewalk, huh, huh, oh, Sunday morning, uh-huh, lies a body just oozing life.
Ink!
And someone sneaking around the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? Oh, there's a tugboat, hop, hop, down by the river, don't you know? With a cement bag just a drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, well, it's there for the weight, babe. Five will get you ten. Old Mackey's back in town. Did you hear about Louis Miller? Well, he disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Mackey spins just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Oh, Jenny Diver, oh, Suki Tawdry, come on, Miss Lottie Lenya, and oh, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, babe, now that Mackey's back in town. I said Jenny Diver, to Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Oh, that line forms on the right, babe, now that Mackey's back in town. Look out, old Mackey is back.
Look out! Mackey's creeping up on you. Mac the Knife, one of the songs that almost never was if Bobby Darin didn't stand his ground. We were talking about him being very bold, and that's a song that even Dick Clark said, kid, it's a mistake. But it became his biggest song.
Yep.
And how many people sing along with that when you perform that?
A good deal. I mean, I would hazard to say there are some people who pay the full ticket price just for that song. They're like, listen, like whatever you do, fine. You can go do your other shenanigans, but you better sing Mac the Knife, and they love it.
Now, I would think that would be like toward the end, an encore song. Because of the fact you're going to hold people. I don't want people to get up and leave after that song.
You're very, very savvy there, very smart. We don't save it quite for the end, but we definitely save it for the second set of the show.
Okay.
Because we can't give it all away at the top. And also, we're talking about his early life in the beginning.
Right, right. You were talking, you're married to an actress, singer,
yep.
Jenna.
Yes.
How did you guys meet? I know Angela and Michael met on stage,
yep.
And it's been a love story ever since. Now they're not only professional partners, but lifetime partners. And how long have you and Jenna been together, and what's the story?
Sure. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary this past October. And we only dated about a year before we got married. So we've been together about 11 years. She and I were both actors out of New York City, but we both met here in the Midwest. We were doing a show in St. Louis, and it was the musical Grease.
Wow. How weird.
Yeah, so I was Duty and she was Frenchie, and we were immediately just struck. We fell in love with each other right away, and I knew I was in trouble. I called my dad. I remember like a week after I met her, I was like, I think I just met the person I'm going to marry, and I don't know what to do. And and it's been that ever since.
Now, how hard is it when you're two performers? You mentioned that, you know, one of the reasons you wanted to stop doing the group project was you were on the road so much.
Sure.
You are both professional entertainers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means leaving home a lot. That means a lot of rehearsal time.
Yeah.
How do you do it? And do you take shifts? You've got a little girl. How do you do that?
So luckily, when you live in a city like Chicago and you have access to the things that are there, we're able to work at a lot of places that are close to home. It still means a lot of rehearsals and a lot of hours, but we divvy it up so that we always have one of us taking care of Presley. And our daughter has the benefit of being able to grow up around a lot of theater people. You know,
mm-hmm.
She the other day, my wife's mother flew into town. and Harriet, and she wanted to see my wife's show, and it was also my daughter's birthday about a week and a half ago. So she came in for that, and we all went to see Jenna's show that she's doing currently at the Mercury Theater, a production of Stephen Sondheim's company. And my daughter Presley stayed backstage with the cast while my wife's mom and I watched the show, and she couldn't have had a better time being around all those theater people. You know, she had her iPad to watch shows, but she was, I think, more watching the action going on behind the scenes than she was her iPad.
Wow. Now, is she showing signs of wanting to get on stage herself?
Unfortunately, yes. She is fully in it. She's been singing and dancing since she could.
How old is she now? Nine?
She's five now. Yeah. So still early. You know, she's just starting kindergarten in the fall. But she seems to be a born performer. She may grow out of it. I'm happy for her either way. But yeah, when there's music on, she's dancing. She loves to sing. She will often make us stop singing mm-hmm. at home because she doesn't want to hear us. She wants to practice her own singing. So now, that's always fun when we're professional singers. She's like, Daddy, stop singing.
I think Michael Ingersoll might want to consider a Shirley Temple tribute.
I agree. Michael, if you are listening, Shirley Temple's time has come and my daughter Presley is ready to go.
Well, I'll get on the good ship, Lollipop. this is a unique situation, and you obviously are friends with Michael mm-hmm. for many years, as you mentioned. This Artist Lounge Live is taking huge advancements in the short time it's been there. He's adding more shows. There's Sam Cooke now and all mm-hmm. these different groups. Are you shocked that the tribute world is as big as it is as opposed to original music?
You know what? I have been surprised that it has been as big as it has. I was more surprised when I started with Jersey Boys at the impact that show had. Once I saw the impact it had, I haven't been as surprised since then because I had already seen it, that mm-hmm. people came out in droves for just the music of this one artist, you know, the Four Seasons. So then to have all these other artists involved was only – it was like the frosting. People would come out and see all these different artists when we were doing Under the Street Lamp. And now with Artist Lounge Live, Michael has – a number of artists that are being covered and people have been really enjoying it. So I have been surprised their support for it. I haven't been surprised at the growth of Artist Lounge Live because I know my friend, Michael, and mm-hmm. he's always, similar to Bobby, he's always been an entrepreneur and he always wanted to kind of build something of his own. And I knew back when he was starting this up that it was going to be something big, and it has. It has been expanding every year and it's gone from a crowd of fans that have supported it in the Chicagoland area and Northwest Indiana, which we couldn't be more grateful for, to a national impact. And he's had shows for, you know, his various Artist Lounge Live artists mm-hmm. in California and Florida and all across the country. And
he's
even
got at least 18 different tribute shows. I'm looking at the website right now. You can go to it, folks, at artistloungelive.com. One of them that I would love to see is the I Gotta Sing the Blues, a salute to Ella, Judy, and Patsy. Obviously, Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland, Patsy Cline. Do you see the combo platter of entertainment coming to Bobby Darin? You were mentioning before about In the Shadow of Frank. Do you see that you and Michael may be putting something together with Sam Cooke and Bobby Darin and doing one of those kind of shows where you've got all these different...
That's a good question. You know, Michael and I actually, we missed working together once we both had left the group. And we worked together with this, but it's obviously kind of a different sort of thing where he's kind of running the show and talking to the venues, and I'm showing up on the day and doing the best show we can. So he and I actually collaborated, and we put our own two-man show together called Lean On Me, The Brotherhood of Rock. And it gives us a chance to stretch outside of any single artist and do a lot of...
Just the two of you?
Yeah, just the two of us. Okay. And so we did a lot of duet groups that you may know. We did the Righteous Brothers and the Everlys, and we did it for the first time in April at a theater in Elgin, and it went really well, and so we're going to be doing some more of that, and honestly, that project is kind of just for fun for the two of us because we just missed working together. So we picked a bunch of songs we thought would be entertaining. Luckily, people enjoyed the show enough that we're going to be doing it some more in the future. But it literally came out of two friends wanting to spend more time together, and similar to the vein of Under the Street Lamp when we were starting that off, but with less structure to it and more fun.
And he's also got a Neil Sedaka tribute that I didn't even know about until I just saw it here. And Neil, like Bobby Darin, is one of those artists that you forget about until you hear all the hits.
Yes, and the gentleman who is doing that concert, John Michael Diaz, he was actually part of the Chicago company of Jersey Boys, and he was in one of the original versions of Under the Street Lamp before I came along, and he had to wow. leave after doing it for just a little bit, and then I came in and basically became the original member. But he's an incredible singer, and he gives a great show.
Wow. This is just an incredible series, and we're fortunate here in Northwest Indiana that Richard brings them over to the theater at the center, and we are presented with these. Now, you're only doing one day. Now, that's what I'm confused about. I know mm-hmm. you're doing two shows, but with Ella and with Judy shows, it was always one day. Why not do a bit of a residency? Why not do a week run?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it's something that we're trying to balance, you know, our optimism and positivity. Positivity with you know, some realistic business sense. We would rather do you know, one day. Luckily, at the Theater of the Center, we get to do two shows in one day. But mm-hmm. we'd rather do one day and have everyone be able to come and have the show sell out. And maybe a few people didn't get to make it in because the show is sold out, than to have, you know, a whole week of shows and maybe we just be performing to a house each night. So we're building up to that. I'm actually going to be doing a week of shows outside St. Louis at the end of September, and so that'll be a good kind of test for us to see, okay, let's see how a week does, which he actually just did with the Judy Garland show that his wife Angela Ingersoll does at this same venue in St. Louis, and it did pretty well. So it's something we're definitely looking to expand into, because a lot of the venues we perform at are houses like Theater at the Center that have a theatrical season, and so sometimes it's nice to fill in something for a week. Mm-hmm. So we want to be able to provide that. We just wanted to make sure that the content could sustain that and maintain it, and it looks like it's going to be able to do that.
Have you guys done any of the showbiz capitals? And when I say that, I mean like the Bransons or the Pigeon Forge or Dollywood or Vegas even?
Not yet. We haven't been able to do those yet. Michael is recently paired up with another producer who's actually out of St. Louis, who is looking to get us into different markets. So we're kind of in a wait and see mode here, okay. to see where we can.
This
we
stuff
can go
would explode in Pigeon Forge.
That's what we're thinking. We're thinking that we can.
You build your own theater.
That's the goal. Let's do it. Wow. Tom, can you make it happen?
Funny you should say. I actually got a couple friends down there.
Perfect.
Let's do another song. What have we not played that we think? Well, we were talking about The Darkness with Mac the Knife and how Bobby was able to make that a finger snap in a party tune. Another one, and we were talking a little off air about, is Artificial Flowers. And this is a Broadway song that mm-hmm. is about sweatshops and child labor. And it's a very dark, horrible story that includes death.
Yep.
But yet it's a fun song in Bobby's world.
It is. You know, I honestly think that Bobby occasionally would look at the material that he wanted to cover and try to – I think he would actually look for material that would be really hard to get people to just enjoy themselves with a song mm-hmm. and make it enjoyable. And he did that across the board. He would find songs that were politically incorrect or downright offensive, and he would turn them into toe-tapping, finger-snapping, undeniable hits time and time again. And this is one of the prime examples.
All right. This is Artificial Flowers.
Alone in the world was poor little Anne, as sweet a young child as you'd find. Her parents had gone to their final reward, leaving their baby behind. Did you hear? This poor little child was only 9 years of age when mother and dad went away. Still, she bravely worked at the one thing she knew to earn her few pennies a day. She made artificial flowers, artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of fashion to wear. She made artificial flowers, you know, those artificial flowers, a fashion from many's despair. With a paper and shears, with some wire and wax, she made up each tulip and mum. Snowflakes drifted into her tenement room. Her baby little fingers grew numb from making artificial artificial flowers. You know those artificial flowers. Flowers for ladies of high fashion to wear. She made artificial flowers. Artificial flowers made from Annie's despair. They found a little Annie hole covered with ice, still clutching her poor frozen shears. Amidst all the blossoms she fashioned by hand and watered with all. Be a heaven where Annie can play in heavenly gardens and bowers. Annie's day, yeah, yet of a halo she'll wear around her head, a garland of genuine flowers. No more artificial flowers, throw away those artificial flowers. Flowers for
Nothing makes you want to get up and dance than a story about a little girl who makes flowers and dies. That is
it's so true.
The gist of that song, Artificial Flowers, in the world of Bobby Darin, and that performance, of course, Christopher Colley Jones, and he is playing Bobby Darin Saturday, June 16th, two shows, 3 p.m., 7:30 p.m. at the Theater at the Center in Munster, 1040 Ridge Road. If you've not been there, check it out. It's a beautiful venue, beautiful sound, beautiful sight lines, and beautiful music. This is a full-fledged show. I mean, I'm showing 18 songs, and you said that not all of the songs are even featured.
No, we do. We do 23 full songs by Bobby Darin through the course of the show. It's funny. You know, I when I did Jersey Boys, I sang 27 Frankie Valli songs, but a lot of those were excerpts, and I thought that was a lot. But Bobby
these
was
are full
prolific.
Songs.
Yeah, full songs.
Wow. Because I know sometimes you do mashups in some of these kind of tribute shows, but these look like they're all full songs.
Yep.
Wow. What is something that you think people will leave this show with that they didn't come in with as far as about Bobby Darin?
Sure. Well, you know, I think, you know, we've talked about his parentage already. I think that a lot of people don't know that, you know, the woman who raised him as his mother turned out to be his grandmother, and his the woman he thought was his older sister was actually his mother. He didn't know that for pretty much his entire life, and that a lot of people don't know that. And a lot of people know he died young, but they didn't know that he kind of knew he was going to die young for the majority of his career, which shaped who he was as a performer. So I think those are kind of impactful stories. But I think also kind of just learning the details of how he met and married Sandra Dee. And then,
that's right, Gidget.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. And that
that's
was a big
right.
part of his life. They
it
had
was,
a volatile relationship, didn't they?
They did, yeah. It was kind of a fairy tale romance of a story. But then, you know, they both were very vibrant professionals and worked a lot, and they had, for whatever reason, it just after 7 years it didn't work. And you know, I sing a song in the show that's one of his big hits, Dream Lover. And when I knew I was doing this show, I knew I had to cover that song because it's one of his hits.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny how sometimes necessity is the mother of invention, because I was doing shows with Under the Street Lamp at the time when I was creating this show, and I knew I'd have to cover Dream Lover, but we were doing Dream Lover in Under the Street Lamp. A wonderful performer who I've mentioned already, Sean Wiley, sings that song with Under the Street Lamp, and he sings it great, and he sings it as a straight-up imitation of what Bobby Darin used to do, and he does it fantastically, and I didn't want to step on his toes in any way, and so I knew when I created this show I wanted to try to do something different. with it. And so necessity kind of created the invention of what that song became. I slowed the song down, and I actually used the song in the show to talk about how their relationship broke apart. And it was a heartbreak for them, but it was also kind of a heartbreak for the country. You know, if you were live in 1960, you were guaranteed to know at least two couples. You knew JFK and Jackie O, and you knew Bobby Darin and Sandra Dee. So mm-hmm. when that fell apart, it felt like something in the country fell apart. And so I used Dream Lover not to put too fine a point on it, in a kind of dreamy way in the show, to kind of give an example of what the feeling may have been like when their relationship was falling apart.
Did he write this for her?
He did not. As far as I know, he did not write this song okay. for her. No, but it was one of his biggest hits. I may be wrong.
All right, this is it. This is Christopher's version of Bobby's Dream Lover.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and feel the magic of her charms. 'Cause I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. A dream lover, where the love, oh, so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow. 'Cause I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope she'll hear my some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do till all my lovers' dreams come true. 'Cause I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Oh, oh, dream lover, I don't wanna dream.
going out to all you dreamy lovers out there.
Thank you.
Christopher Kale Jones, that is his take on that old Bobby Darin song that he had performed and I guess at some points dedicated to his former estranged wife, Sandra Dee, who was America's sweetheart. I mean, in that era, Sandra Dee was the girl next door that everybody pined for.
She was, yeah. She was, yeah, she was America's princess, and it's funny. You know,
the original Gidget, no, not Sally Field.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, she was, and it was, the relationship when they got together had all those trappings about it. You know, she was this princess-like fairy tale girl, and, you know, Bobby was this guy, this rough around the edges mm-hmm. Italian dude from the wrong side of the tracks, and so it wasn't expected when they got together, but then it was kind of like a Beauty and the Beast excitement when it mm-hmm. did happen because, like, oh, wow, she's with this kind of rough guy who hangs out with gangsters, similar to kind of the trappings that were around Sinatra and Dean Martin, those
right.
kind of guys. And so you didn't expect, you know, the woman of you know, a girl, really, a princess of this kind of purity and you know, America's princess to be with him. But then everyone just kind of rallied around it and really was swept away.
Just to underscore, for those of you that are listening that are a little younger that may not remember the Sandra Dee era and the hoopla around her, just to underscore her impact, look at the Grease soundtrack where Olivia Newton-John or whoever is playing the role is singing, "Look at me, I'm Sandra Dee."
Yep.
And that is a tribute to or a tip of the hat to the impact that Sandra Dee had. And Bobby Darin wound up winning her hand in the 7 years of lots of headlines and lots of fights and mm-hmm. lots of making up. And
yep.
They were a drama. They were reality TV before we had it.
They were.
Because they were in the news all the time. Have you, is Sandra Dee doing anything? Have you ever had any response from her on any of the Bobby Darin stuff that you know of that Dodd might be doing or?
Yeah, well, she's passed on now.
She has?
Yes.
Okay, I thought she was still with us.
No, just recently, I forget the day, but yeah, no, she's passed on. She, you know, she had a complicated life before and after Bobby. You know, she was very young when she went into theatrical and a movie career. It's if you look online, they'll give her her birthday as 1942, I believe, but some of the family members have said that she was actually born in 1944, but they fibbed about her age so that she could start working in movies. So they said that she was 16, but she was actually 14. A lot were saying when they got to when she started doing movies. So if you kind of extrapolate that out, then she was really just 16 or 17 years old when she met Bobby. So she was still kind of coming into her own and just passing her adolescence when she met this kind of dynamic force in Bobby, and they got together. And I think the combination of her, you know, growing up, and the combination of Bobby kind of going after all of these career pursuits, it just made it really hard to kind of keep things together. I'm sure there were other complicating factors. You can never know anyone's full story from the outside. But yeah, it was definitely a complicated thing and a beautiful thing while it lasted.
Do you cover that in the show, the Sandra Dee years?
We do, yeah.
Okay. 1961, absolutely. They met, starring in Come September with Rock Hudson.
That's right.
Was that Bobby's first movie? He didn't do many movies, did he?
He didn't do many. It was the first one that anyone knew about. He'd done, I think, one before that that I don't even know if it got a national release. So yes, it was his first big movie, and he sang a song in that movie and played kind of the young romantic lead in that as well, so the secondary lead after Rock Hudson. But yeah, he had always wanted to do more acting work and was even nominated for an Academy Award. I don't know if you remember, he did a movie called Captain Newman, M.D. And he played a shell-shocked soldier who basically came back from war and went to a psychiatric war hospital, and they worked with him to kind of try to put him back together after he had just seen the horrors he'd seen. And he got nominated for Academy Award for that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bobby Darin is no longer with us. We lost him back in 1973 at the age of 37, living 17 years longer than the doctors thought he would.
Mm-hmm.
But the music is alive and well, and Christopher Kale Jones is bringing it Saturday, June 16th. Two shows, 3 p.m., 7:30 p.m. at the Theater at the Center, 1040 Ridge Road in Munster, Indiana. We've got just a few minutes left. We're going to get to another song, but before we we go, let's talk a little bit more. Give me the websites one more time, how they can follow you, how they can follow the Artists Lounge series and different things. Connect us here.
Sure. So the series that that Tom's been talking about is the Artists Lounge Live series. You can find it at artistloungelive.com. And then I have a website for this particular show, celebrating the life and music of Bobby Darin, at www.darinshow.com. And you can also find my personal website that'll let you know of any things I'm doing with this concert, as well as any other performing exploits, at ChristopherCalleJones.com. That's where you can find all the information. I'm really hoping you can come on out to the show at Theater at the Center. It's a beautiful space. It sounds great. It looks great. And we're going to have a really good time on June 16th at 3 p.m. and 7:30 p.m.
Now, two shows in one day, how taxing is that on you?
You know, it's not super easy, but it's not horrible either. You know, I designed this show so I could be able to get through it and be able to give be able to give an impactful performance to everyone who comes to it. So I kind of like being able to do a couple in a day because I don't have time to think.
Okay.
I just keep moving and moving around and singing the songs, and it makes it more fun.
Now, it's a long show. It's 90 some minutes. We talk about multiple shows back in the vaudeville days, and groups like the Ink Spots and things, they would do four or five shows a day sometimes.
Yeah.
They'd be shorter shows,
sure.
But still, when I think, you know, the human voice, the throat is an instrument, and like any instrument, it needs to be taken care of and tuned. And how do you sing professionally? What tips would you have for anyone that's listening? And again, Harmonies for Healing, a program you did here recently,
yeah,
for PBS at the old Star Theater, you brought a lot of young folks and even older folks that were amateur singers and kind of tutored them a little bit, mentored them.
True.
What is the suggestion you would have for voice care?
Absolutely. So my grab bag of things that I would say to try is, first, everyone's voice is unique and individual. So some things work for some people and some things work better for others. So the things that tend to impact the voice most are sleep, making sure you get enough sleep, like any sort of vigorous event, making sure your voice is hydrated. So that also means like not drinking a lot of caffeine or alcohol, because mm-hmm. that can dehydrate you. And also, I do vocal warm-ups before and after shows. A lot of people don't think about warming up after you do a show. But it's like an athletic event. So if you don't, let's say you went out, you know, like an Olympic performer, and you were doing a bunch of sprints, if you didn't warm down afterwards, your muscles would be tight the next day. So
how do you warm down?
Sure. So what you do is, it's similar to a warm up. It's just very, very gentle. You're just kind of doing scales up and down. I've learned some techniques where I can kind of massage my throat and the muscles to make them loose again, so that I don't wake up tight the next day.
I have never heard of that.
Yeah.
I've heard of warm ups, the importance of that, and the la 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 la.
Something I picked up in the Jersey Boys world, and all the Frankies would do it. They had a great voice teacher named Katie Agresta out of New York who would help people with that. And yeah, it was a new
all
thing for me.
All the Frankies. You're part of a little
fraternity
there.
Club. Yes, it's true.
Would you go back and do Frankie again?
Oh, absolutely. I would definitely do it. You know, they called me back to do it about a year and a half after I'd finished, and I went to Las Vegas and did it for about a week and a half, and that was a blast. If they ever needed my help again, I'd be happy to do it.
One last thing I do want to touch on, and it's kind of a cool thing that people may or may not know, is you and your wife, Jenna, performed for the Obamas.
We did.
What was that all about?
So we had worked at the Ford's Theater in D.C., the very famous Ford's Theater.
The Ford Theater?
Yeah, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the Ford Theater where it
old,
happened.
Honest Abe.
That's right. Kicked it. So we did Little Shop of Horrors there. I was Seymour and she was Audrey, and they were doing a 4th of July celebration that year, and it was televised. And then during the commercial breaks, they wanted more performers that were going to be there, and so they drew from their shows that they had done that year. So we came out and sang a song from Little Shop of Horrors, and the president and his wife were in attendance.
Not in the opera box.
No, they were not in the opera box. They were down on the main floor.
There you go.
My favorite story from that is, right before the show began, General Colin Powell came backstage because he had ripped a button on his tuxedo, and so the costume shop was repairing his button, and he was chatting up my wife right before the show began, and it was really kind of fun to see,
wow,
you know, the elite of our country kind of mixing with us lowly actors.
All right. You can keep up with Christopher at ChristopherKaleeJones.com. And Kalee is spelled like Kale, K-A-L-E. Don't mispronounce it. ChristopherKaleeJones.com. And again, at the Artist Lounge, keep up with all the great shows. That's ArtistLoungeLive.com. And of course, see him Saturday, June 16th. That's 3 p.m., 7:30 p.m. at Theater at the Center, theateratthecenter.com, where you can get your tickets, more information. And Christopher, thank you for joining us.
Tom, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
2 hours go quick.
I know, super quick.
Let's close with a song. You said this is one of your favorites from the show. Tell us why.
Absolutely. You know, I talk about how Bobby's music is celebratory, and this song, I think, typifies it more than most. It was one of those great Broadway shows from songs from My Fair Lady, and he took it, gave his own spin to it, and made it just a blast.
All right. This is On the Street Where You Live, Bobby Darin, done by Christopher. Adios, everybody.
Often walked down this street before, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All at once am I several stories high, knowing I'm on the street where you live. Are there lilac trees in the heart of town? Can you hear a lark in any other part of town? Does enchantment pour out of every door? No, it's just on the street where you live. And oh, the towering feeling just to know somehow you are near. The overpowering feeling that any second you may suddenly appear. People stop and stare, they don't bother me, for there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by, street where you live. And oh, 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 the towering feeling just to know somehow you are near. The oh so overpowering feeling that any second you may suddenly appear. People stop and stare, they don't bother me, for there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go.